Episode 14 of Season 17, China Tutors Uber for Pennies. I'm Lyle Troxell, recording in Los Gatos, California, and in the room with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Hello, Miles.
How's it going?
Good. You know, I introduce you every week in kind of an insulting way, and today I'm just going to say thank you for being here. Do you think of that as insulting?
I do a fair amount of insulting on my own, so anything I receive is fair game.
Fair enough. That makes sense to me. We're going to talk in the second half of the show quite a bit about some new Uber information, just to basically how the company's been run, and some we're going to continue our bashing on how bad this company is, but some interesting details that affects other questions and raises other concerns about how iOS protects its users and other things of that nature. But first, let's talk about web tutorials.
Sure. There has been some... Well, the computing industry has always been self-sustaining in a way that as much as there are new technologies coming out, there are always people that will put up documentation to try to explain how to use that technology.
Yeah.
In many ways, that documentation can be as innovative or a new way of delivery or an analogy being put forth that makes it amazingly accessible. And will drive its adoption.
Yeah. I mean, I recall the reason why I think Ruby on Rails took off so well is David Heinemeier-Heinzen, who presented how it worked, did a great talk on it and showed the simplicity of using it and kind of built into the development environment itself an easy way to boot up database web applications.
Right.
So easy, in fact, that you didn't have to learn very much and you were already started. That kind of drove Ruby on Rails' ability to take off. Also, the Ruby language has a kind of elegant beauty.
Right. And before Ruby on Rails, there were things like PHP and MySQL. And this was a very easy way to have a data store and then spit out that information out to a web page through that, very simple templating language. The problem there, some of it came from the early days of PHP because it just didn't have a lot of the rough edges smoothed out yet.
Mm-hmm.
But this continued on even till today, where researchers from several German universities were checking code bases for PHP and the like on GitHub and found that many of them had the exact same or very similar class of error, the SQL injection attack. And this could be directly tied to how tutorials were relaying, because the tutorials were meant to be very simple. But even beyond that, they were showing something that was not best practices.
Can you give an example?
In general, the rule with computing, across the board, doesn't matter what platform you're on or what you're doing, you never trust the user.
You never trust the inputs.
Yes.
Right.
Ever.
You basically, anytime you're developing an application, you want to think about the stuff that's going to flow through, even though you might expect the application to perform a certain way with data coming in. You have to make sure that data can't do something that's bad. And that's like, anytime you've heard the term SQL injection, that's what we're talking
right.
about.
And this is especially true for the web.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is just... You put up a web server and someone connects up to it and you have no idea where they are, where they're from, or what their intentions are. Now, many of the features of PHP, such as talking to a MySQL database, the information being given in a lot of tutorials was, here's most of this SQL query, structured query language, and then we're going to take in a little bit of information that comes from the user that might be an ID that you're looking for
the general idea in the tutorial is it's very simple at first, and they slowly add things and add things and add things to kind of walk you through the process of getting your data online.
Right. And you would need to get that ID from the user. There's mm-hmm. some information you need to get from the user, but the question is whether you trust it or not,
try to
sanitize it. And so these tutorials, what they will do is, you can just pass in this parameter through an HTML form and then get it through what's known as the underscore post variable in the case of sending something through a form method of post, and take the ID that's, from this form. And it works just fine in your development. The problem is that if someone doesn't want to use an HTML form, they can just create their own and post it to your site.
Right.
They can construct something. You can construct it with a command line utility called wget or curl. And replace that simple ID, which is supposed to be a number. You're expecting a number. Mm-hmm. And replace that with a whole sequence of characters like a semicolon to close the current statement,
start programming in the SQL language itself, allowing them to do anything that you could do in the database.
Right. An arbitrary database call. Right. Yeah. Or, for that matter, delete your database.
Delete
all your information in there, which is another common vector. And the way this happens is because you just say, here's this SQL statement, and I'm going to combine two strings. In other words, text data. I'm going to combine it into a single contiguous string of characters. And that's why a feature known as parameterized queries was created.
Right.
The idea is that you never want to just pass it in without having any type of sanitation. Even if you want to get another string, you want to make sure that certain special characters that can be used to harm the system have been
made safe at the boundary.
Yes,
level.
Made safe. Thank you. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, interesting. So how does this? What's this news story that you've got?
So the news story is, and this is something that I and others in the industry had known about and seen for quite some time, is that online tutorials either were dated or they were coming from someone with a naive notion of security, mm-hmm. and they ended up being, you know, otherwise well-written articles. Now, they're very approachable. Maybe they're on a site that is very good to read, maybe a good layout. But the technical angle of that data, or the code portion of that article, was rife with problems. And then people who were just
problems,
learning...
Not from a learning perspective, but problems from a production perspective, meaning that if you put that code into... final situation, you'd have a serious problem.
A little bit of both, because it's part of a learning problem because you are learning bad practices. One of the goals with programming is learning good patterns so that when you see bad things, it immediately sticks out.
Yes.
If you learn bad patterns, that becomes normalized in your mind.
Right. In fact, it's kind of a general understanding that as you work on a code base, especially at someone else's code base, you kind of want to follow the patterns and paradigms that are there. Part of that process is making sure that the language you're writing, the stuff you're writing, is still readable by the other people. And so it is common for you to kind of take the practices of the code base that exists. So if you're learning a code base that has flaws mm-hmm. in it, you'll never necessarily catch them because, hey, some other people were doing it. Somebody else already thought about this problem maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But this was the first time I'd ever seen where someone actually went and did the research and looked at all of these items that are up there. And to be honest, I haven't looked at these PHP tutorials or things like that in many years, and I hadn't really thought about them in that much time. But they're looking at current projects on GitHub, and it's just not really a safe thing to do. It's never been a good idea, but it's especially not in 2017. It's just asking for trouble, especially when you have your source code up on GitHub, because you have source code up as open source in many cases and publicly viewable, that not only can someone try to test the site to see if it suffers from an SQL vulnerability or a cross-site mm-hmm. scripting vulnerability, but they're able to actually look at your source code and find out ahead of time where to target your attacks.
Oh, interesting. So it's an analysis-based attack. Interesting.
Well, I mean, it could be. I mean, this is the extra... Before, it used to be it was all a black box. It was just a website, and you just tried different things. Now you can actually look at the code and see, oh, there's a string concatenation. I'll start there.
Right. Okay, interesting article. Thank you. The penny in the United States is obviously relatively useless. Right now, at this point, when you purchase things, most of the time, if you get a penny back, you toss it in a jar or you can get a penny out. In fact, pennies cost more to create by the U.S. government than they're worth.
Yes.
Quite a bit, actually. So if you took...
Well, quite a bit more like...
in the sense that it's a fractional metal.
1.3 cents to get a penny, something
like
that.
Yeah, but the actual material, the metal in the penny, is worth more than a penny. So you have the situation where you could theoretically start mass melting of pennies and make a profit. That would be illegal, by the way, a federal offense. But starting this week, South Korea has started a trial which could result in banishing its coins from their system completely. First off, though the penny's useless, when you travel in Great Britain, the pound is a great coin to have. Like I like small coin. I like coins that have value.
Well, we have
that
dollar
number.
Coins here too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree that the dollar coin here is nice. It's not as common to use.
Canada,
and be able to
the
use.
Loon and the tune.
Yeah. In any case, in South Korea, this project, the way they're getting rid of the coin, not just by dropping it, because in the United States, we just drop the 1 cent. All stores could stop doing 1 cent values and just round up to 5 cents, and it would still be.
Which we've done. In the mid-19th century, we had hay pennies, and
right.
the U.S. government
penny.
Got rid of them. Yeah.
So we have removed pennies before. But in any case, one way to do this and the way that South Korea is doing it is actually producing this card, this Bank of Korea debit card. It's kind of like a gift card. And when you're in the store and you're doing purchases, you can hand this card over to the teller and your change will be put onto the credit of that card. So it's effectively like you can use cash normally, but you also carry this other thing to take on change. It's an interesting idea. The thing about using cash, though, the whole point of using cash is to be removing yourself from the system where you're not having a trail. But the point of this, of course, is that money is yours directly. There's not going to be an extra service charge to use this card. Of course, if I go into a store and I use my credit card in the United States, the store is getting charged like 25 cents for my use of the credit card. And therefore, the change values on there, of course, there is no change because they only reduce a certain amount. But a store is going to rather have cash in the U.S. than a credit card because they make better money that way. In any case, I thought it was kind of cool to see a way of doing this without actually just dropping the coin, but instead just making it a lot easier to save it up.
See, I'm still in favor of drop the coins, round everything to the nearest 5 cents.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to go, too. I don't know the coin system, of course, in Korea. They might have more useless coins.
And for that matter, getting rid of the $100 bill and the $50 bill.
You don't want to get those? Why do you want to get rid of those?
Because they are the most counterfeited bills in the world. Most counterfeited.
Which ones?
And the $100 bill.
And the 50?
And the 50.
I think the $100 bill might be a useful bill to have.
The thing is, for the most part, everyday use, you don't need hundreds.
Yeah, you're poor, boy.
No, I'm... Come on, seriously.
I just used hundreds this weekend because I was selling furniture from my mother-in-law's stuff that was being... And so I actually had some $300 or 300s. And you're right. I haven't seen hundreds in my hand for, I don't know, a long time. They're just not a very useful
But they
bill.
Are in great usage in cash-only economies that tend to be on the illicit side.
Yeah.
So if you take away the $100 bill and the $50 bill, it won't affect most people's day-to-day lives. But it will severely impact the portability of cash as it flows through borders.
By the way, South Korea, the South Korean 10 won coin represents the equivalent of around half a British penny. And the largest coin value is a 500 won, which is around 35 pennies or 44 cents in the U.S., to give you some context here. In any case, there's a note, a bank note, it's actually 100 won, which of course is even smaller than, 10 cents. Anyway, I think it was kind of neat that they're doing. All right, moving on. Miles, you wanted to tell me about space cargo.
China has launched its first cargo spacecraft for their space station.
That's awesome.
And
when you say for their space station, how big of a space station do they have?
Well, it's smaller than the International Space Station, but...
aren't they a big player in the International Space Station as well?
I don't know how big a player. I know that they're a player. Mm-hmm. The Tiangong 2, which is their space station that's up there, is currently crewless. Mm-hmm. So it's not... It doesn't have the same population as the International Space Station, although the International Space Station will soon have less crew as well. I've heard plans of decommissioning. It's been up there for a while. But it's always good to hear, diversity of folks getting up there. And it goes along with just more nations being involved, in addition to the private sector where you have businesses like SpaceX with their reusable rockets. It's looking like another space race. And the thing is, when the U.S. got to the moon and the Soviet Union just kind of said, "Uncle, we're not going to do that anymore." The U.S. lost interest, and that's sad. And
yeah,
it's so refreshing to see that competition come up again, because that has always driven the U.S. to push forward in that regard.
So you think that maybe China blasting off this rocket, this crewless rocket, and getting cargo quickly up is going to maybe motivate us to have a battle of scientific endeavor?
They are not at the current levels where NASA is, and certainly not where SpaceX is, although NASA and SpaceX are going for different goals in a lot of ways. But they do make sure that you're looking in your rearview mirror. It makes sure that you see where the competition is and where you want to go with there.
Yeah.
And it's also nice to see other nations and other organizations start going into space, because everyone has some different ideas. And it's good to get inspiration from other areas. If you have just the same thing over and over again, you have a monoculture and nothing, you know,
yeah,
you have a single point of failure.
You know, to give some history to China's space exploration, China was excluded from the 301 member International Space Station.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah. Mainly due to U.S. legislation barring competition and concerns over Chinese space program made too connected to their military, even though you could claim the same thing to us, but of course we have a lot of power in that sense. And Chinese officials are now looking into making their internalization of their program and help finance other countries, things of that nature. So they're trying to outreach a bit to become part of the space community, if you will. And it did launch its first mission in 2003, and it has staged a spacewalk and landed the Jade Rabbit rover on the moon, of course a non-manned rover. And they plan to do other things on Mars and bring back samples from Mars in 2020 is their plan. So they have got some big plans, which is cool to
awesome.
See a little bit of success in space. All right. Well, I'll just mention that since I'm talking a little bit about finance today, the Galaxy S8, which of course is a phone, there's a potential for the Galaxy S8 smartphone to use eye scanning or retina scanning to confirm mobile transactions. And
that seems error prone.
Potentially, yeah. According to sources, Samsung Card Co. is seeking to apply the iris scanner on its mobile application, allowing users to make financial transactions right from their phone. I think the reason why you're saying, well, that seems sketchy, is how do you know that it's an eye and not a photo of an eye? I mean, I am pretty sure there's photos of my retina on photographs online right now. But, of course, same as the fingerprint as well. Of course, with the fingerprint, you do have to have a physical, textural thing to touch. The eye could really just be a picture. Unless, of course, they've got a little bit more technology around it, like motion and things of that nature.
Yeah. Because when you have your phone in your hand, it's really hard to bring your thumb over to it. Fingerprint reader.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
in any case, the implementation is different, because it used to be that you could just do an unlocks and, you know, a user authentication stuff, and now you can actually potentially do transactions, which is cool in the sense that there's moving forward with making transactions simpler. I got to say that I am loving having Google, the Apple Wallet on my phone, whatever the heck that thing's called. I use it whenever a store has the capability. I charge to my, you know, Visa card or something through my phone, and I find it extremely useful. And I love when the store doesn't require a receipt signed. Sometimes the stores are like, I pull up my phone, I do a fingerprint, and I scan my, you know, my phone in front of the device, and it goes bling, and then they ask me to sign a piece of paper. I look at them like, seriously? It's completely useless. And every time,
well, not completely useless. It is still useful for them for tax purposes.
Yeah, for tax purposes. But I intentionally do not make a repeatable signature every time I'm asked to do that. So it is completely useless in the sense of identifying me. But we knew that anyway. Let's do some Ubers.
I have to be honest, I don't want to spend that much time on Uber.
I know. We have so many articles about Uber, though, so I do feel like we have to touch base a bit on it. So why don't we start by just describing your article, CEO Plays with Fire. What's this Uber CEO Playing with Fire story?
This is a basically a professional biography of the Uber CEO, Travis Kalanick. Yes, mm-hmm. Done by New York Times. And it talks about his tenacity for trying to find business opportunities and trying for success, but also highlights the moral flexibility that he has displayed in doing so.
That's a polite way of saying it.
And this article brought forth some information from a two-year-old conversation with Tim Cook, of CEO of Apple, that was a bit disturbing on its face. And then people were wondering, well, what is this? How does it technically work? Which is, when you deleted the Uber app, they still had the ID. So they were, when you installed the app, they were getting the Apple unique user ID off of the phone,
yeah,
Cherry Phone Notes. But Apple had removed the ability for apps to do so.
Yes.
So Uber had basically done a little bit of tinkering in the system to try to find where they were storing that information and was getting it against the terms of service for Apple.
The general idea here was that they were making an identifier that they could hold on to and have a long-term identification for the phone, which is against Apple's policies.
Right.
Apple stopped producing this UUID capability. In fact, now in iOS, when you say, I want a unique identifier for the user, you get a unique identifier that's for your app and you, or mm-hmm. your app install
right.
for that user, and it isn't a trackable cross applications. And additionally, I think a new install of the app would also cause you to get a new pseudo UUID. A UUID is a universally
unique identifier.
In any case, so Apple stopped that practice because of the tracking capability. So,
well, because ad agencies and the like were abusing it,
right?
Which is why
three different apps on the phone could get the UID of a user, and then they could coalesce the data on some other service saying this same person is using these three things. So you don't want that capability because it allows applications to and businesses to track you in different ways. To be clear, this story about in New York Times is a lot of unknowns because they're talking about getting a unique identifier, and we'll go into why in a second. But it's possible to identify a phone in other ways, and it could be that there's still a vulnerability to do that. Now, most likely, since this thing occurred, whatever Uber's doing, and Uber got caught, and Apple, Tim Cook kind of called him on it, it's possible that Apple has closed that loophole. At the same time, if I think about all the things I can do as an iOS developer on a phone, I would assume that it would be pretty easy for me to fingerprint a phone in some ways.
Right, but it goes further than this, because as we mentioned, it was against Apple's terms of service. Uber engineers found the looked at Apple's IP block, wrote their software in such a way that if it was within the Apple IP block, that functionality did not present itself.
So what you're saying is when Apple tried testing it inside their at Apple, mm-hmm. they tried testing the system to be approved for the App Store, that feature didn't get turned on.
Right.
It's one of those things we've actually known about as a vulnerability for a long time on these App Store review processes. You can also do date-based things or other location-based things, like if you're in Canada, it'll operate this way. And most likely, Apple's not going to test it in Canada. So there's a lot of ways of subverting the test, you know, making the app different on a test process than later. Time is one of the best ones, right?
Right. But nonetheless, this is not something you do because you feel you're on the up and up. You're doing this because you know you're breaking the rules, but you're going to do it anyway.
Yeah. To be clear, one of the reasons why you might want to do this is if you install – now, this is Daring Fireball's author, and of course I'm blank – John Gruber is suggesting that the reason why you would want – Uber would want to put an identification on this user is there's twofold. One is you could detect whether the phone – the app was removed from the phone and then reinstalled. So you could actually potentially connect – of phone's usage over time, even if it was different users. You'd know where the phone went. You'd be able to connect two Uber accounts, potentially with friendship or with a sibling. So there's that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you uninstalled the phone to be off for a while and then reinstalled to try again, Uber could potentially know, oh, this might be a fraudulent case, right? This might be someone trying to trick their system. And I guess there's some fraud happening with Uber in some areas. I have to say, though, the other thing that could occur is if you uniquely identified and it's not based on the application itself, other applications could also generate that unique identifier. So you could imagine so there's a lot of open libraries for doing things like advertising. Mm-hmm. So if I want to build an app for some store in Santa Cruz or something, and I want to make some money off of it, I can go use an ad agency and put their code in my app. And what that would allow to happen is every time a page is viewed in the app, a little ad banner would show up. That ad banner is served by the agency, and everybody's happy because the customer gets a free product. I get some money from the ad agency, and the ad agency gets to make revenue off of the customer. But if that bit of code also can generate that unique UID, and they collude. Uber colludes with another company. Now you have a situation where you can know more about the user, what other apps they're using potentially, what are the things they're doing. And so there's a lot of other things that can take place when you can generate this kind of unique identifier, which they were obviously doing in some way.
Right. And you were bringing up there may be potential business cases for them to do this that are not necessarily evil.
Right. Exactly.
But a large number of people were using it for evil purposes. That's why Apple shut it down. So
yes.
Because there was too much of a moral hazard at play there.
Now, and additionally, when you have a situation where you have a valid business reason and you have a partnership with Apple, and Apple sees your valid business reason like, oh, well, people keep on deleting the account and then using a one-time ride thing. They use the one-time ride thing from a friend with a fake email address, and then they do it again later, and they do it again later, and we want to stop that. And Apple can be like, cool, no problem. You can get an identifier that will only work for your application. Here's the protocol for that. And now, every time you install the application, you know whether that phone has been accessed before on this application, which limits the scope of your identification of the user by allowing Apple to intercede and provide that service to you. Additionally, one of the things that was frustrating with this article, the first time I read this article, it said that Uber was, after the app was removed from this, it was tracking users. Now, to do that, to achieve that, to actually track people after the fact, kind of breaks all the sandboxing rules that Apple has on their operating system. The idea that when you install an app on your phone, and this happens on Android and on iOS, the application, if it wants to know your location, has to ask you in a generic dialogue to track you. And what that basically means is when you say yes or no, if you approve, Apple is going to provide to that application, either the application itself or the service that they offer, the tracking information, where you are, location information. And the reason this is delegated at that boundary is to make sure that you don't install a calculator that can track where you are. So the first time this article went around, that was what the claim was. And the first thought was like, how would they possibly do that? The only way they could possibly do that is really cracking, like really stepping outside the bounds of the phone. They weren't doing that. Tracking really meant identifying with this identifier we're talking about.
Now, a meeting with Tim Cook 2 years ago, you know, he gets invited to Apple headquarters. Tim Cook sends him down.
Like, CEO of Apple.
We know you're doing this. Our engineers found you doing this. Stop it. Or we're going to remove your app from the App Store. Now, if Apple had done this, it's a huge swath of cell phones that
it would really
suddenly,
hurt business.
Yeah, sure. Suddenly Uber doesn't have access to. Like, it was really pushing that point. Now, some people have mentioned like, oh yeah, Apple's really caring about privacy. And to give kudos to Tim Cook, he has taken stances on many issues where I say, you didn't have to do that. That's great. Good for you. In this case, I feel very much like Uber was something that was a bit of a selling point. They're going to make more money with Uber than they would without them. But they couldn't have them do this thing that was contrary to the terms of service.
I mean, keeping in mind that all the money that Uber was pulling in through the phone, Apple was getting 30% of that. So it's a high motivation for Apple to keep Uber on the App Store. And that threatening conversation was basically, hey, this is good for all of us, but don't break the rules.
Right.
And that was that.
I mean, it was very much a stop doing this or else. Because it would hurt Uber a lot more than it would Apple. For Apple, it would be like, oh, yeah, it's a loss of revenue. For Uber, it would have been catastrophic. Now, that's not the end of what Uber has been doing, though. And I highly recommend reading this New York Times article where it goes through just a litany of items.
What catches me is not really the Uber. It's really this CEO. He just seems driven to a point of someone. It's not someone I want to be a friend with.
Yes, except that CEO is not coding all of this stuff. Some responsibility has to be laid on the individual software engineer who's writing stuff, who is saying that either is getting marching orders and saying, do this, and saying, oh, okay, this sounds fine.
Well, give an example of something else, because I can see the marching orders of, hey, you know, get a unique identifier. We want to stop fraud in some places. Seems like something that an engineer might be like, okay. But is there another example of something that you feel that the CEO was asking his employees to do something that they should have maybe not done?
Uber is reportedly tracking Lyft drivers.
This is that project called Hell, I think?
Yes. The project
how this works.
It's an internal software program. It's called Hell. How it works is they set up multiple Lyft accounts.
Lyft, of course, is the biggest competitor of Uber besides mm-hmm. taxi companies. Okay, they set up artificial Lyft accounts, like computer accounts that are really a computer program.
They're not a
that
person.
Are signed in as
they
Lyft.
Are a proxy for Uber International.
Okay,
and they use that to track where Lyft vehicles are. To say, like, I'm going to be looking for a Lyft, so I want to see prices and I want to see where the drivers are. And it's able to, they're able to track, like, when they're able to track where the drivers are, they're able to map that over with drivers that are also Uber drivers.
Okay, first off, the first part of this of just saying, where are the Lyft cars and how much are they charging seems like good competitive analysis, right? You're basically saying, where's my competition, where are they focused, and how much money there is. At some level, if it was being collected in a legal way, and we'll get to that in a second, that might be kind of viable. But the next process you're talking about, they actually ended up doing, this is really devious. So you said that they then tracked, they found the location of Lyft vehicles, and then they looked at their own vehicles, mm-hmm. or, excuse me, their own contractors that are driving their own vehicles.
Figured out which ones were doing both.
Working Lyft, for Lyft and Uber,
yeah,
which
they call double dipping,
lot of people, a lot of Uber drivers I know do both, yeah.
And because they were able to see this view, able to see what Lyft's prices were, they were able to target individuals to try to figure out how do I get them to preferentially choose Uber over Lyft with this otherwise privileged data. Now, the data about Lyft, you'd be fine just saying this is competitive, except that it violates terms of service for Lyft to just sign in when you're not a person, when you're not trying to be a client. There's a certain conduct that you must have.
And in fact, whether and how this is done could violate many laws. Because when you are super – like let's say Lyft puts some kind of identifier in its app when it installs its app. And so now that app has access to the APIs that allow it to communicate to the Lyft servers. If you circumvent that and backwards engineer that, and then you create an application that looks just like a Lyft app, because of course they're not going to take
a
phone and put it in the location. They're going to send the information that, hey, this is my geolocation to the Lyft servers. So they are backwards engineering and subverting the process that Lyft is doing, and that is basically in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
So, well, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in this case.
And the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but both of them, because they backward engineered any kind of encryption process would actually cause it to. So,
right. This is the suit, the civil suit that Lyft is bringing toward Uber, which is citing breach of contract, unfair business practices, stealing trade secrets, in addition to violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
So Lyft is suing them?
Yes.
Good. I'm sure there are
plenty of suits going back and forth between Lyft and Uber anyway, just because they're both large companies that are highly competitive.
Sure.
But this was something that's new on there. And it, frankly, is not out of character for what we've been hearing about from Uber. And this type of program is the type of thing that I was talking about where someone has to code it, because the CEO of Uber wasn't coding this. This is someone down the chain. Now, you can say, you know,
right,
they need the job, so they were doing what they were paid to do. But that's very much I was following orders excuse and not much of one in the first place.
First off, the competitive analysis aspect of it does make sense. Hey, how much is Lyft charging? Where do they have their cars focused? We want to make sure to blow them out of the water. We're going to put the cars there too. But as soon as they start using Lyft's data, they have to agree to those terms of service. And right there, it's not valid.
Right.
So right there, you're basically doing something illegal. And that's where you're saying, hey, if I was the engineer on that project, I wouldn't want to feed my children. Is that what you're saying?
I realize that having a job is one thing. At the same time, if you were a software engineer at Uber, is it really all that hard to find another job? Now, admittedly, you may not get the same benefits, but there's still that question of where does ethics lie? If you are a software engineer, what is the line? Everybody has a line. Like, would you write software that would kill someone? Obviously, that's an extreme example. But if there is a moral hazard somewhere, you have a responsibility, not just as a software engineer, but as a human being, to evaluate this is not ethically correct.
Well, I think you and I have that. And I'd be so shocked if you did something like that, and I wouldn't do something like that myself. But I don't think that everyone has that same feeling that being ethical is paramount. And I think that when, and you're right, that an Uber engineer that has, is doing a good job and can code can get another job in the in Silicon Valley, right? There's a lot of, we're lacking enough software engineers here currently. At the same time, changing jobs is difficult for a lot of reasons.
Sure.
It's not, you know, it's not just the pay and it's not just about the stability aspect.
I don't want to be totally flippant about
it.
It's a question of, but there still has to be some accountability. Otherwise, you are complicit. It's not a question of, oh, someone told me how to do it. If you knew that you were doing something illegal or just plain unethical,
yeah,
there is still, you can't be neutral on that. You have to make that choice because you're the one who's in the in front of the keyboard, you know, running the compiler.
There is a, and I have to say that I can see the engineer that goes, that's an interesting problem. Let me figure that out and get excited about it. I would get excited about that myself. I would potentially, you know, investigate that myself when I was 14 or something before I really started understanding my impact on the world. So I can see that it would be a challenge and an interesting problem to figure out. Were they threatening the Uber drivers that are there or were they enticing them?
I believe they were using enticing enticement. At the same time, it's asymmetrical.
Yes.
If they're able to see how much you were making otherwise, but you can't see what the bargaining chip is, with if they're just going to go, let's see if we put this much.
And basically what you're saying is that they could on the fly kind of go, well, let's see, that person at Lyft is going to make this much money if they take the ride. If they take it with us, we'll make sure it's a little bit higher. And you're slowly basically squeezing those drivers out of using Lyft. To be clear, the New York Times article does denote that Lyft also has competitive analysis practices as well, right? All businesses do this kind of thing.
Competitive analysis is, yes.
It's not an issue here.
Right. It is not the issue here.
Well, I think that what came about for me was that, you know, as we started seeing how horribly female engineers were being treated at Uber with other stories we've covered throughout this year, I was avoiding Uber. I had deleted the app and the... You know, I've option to use Lyft, and so I've just decided to use Lyft. It's not as good in some ways. But reading this article, and I've been wondering, you know, are they going to be able to resolve this? Are they going to be able to restructure such that I can trust that they are doing a better job being fair to their employees? And from what I can read through this article, there's no way that this company is going to change around with the same CEO in place.
That same,
he operates that way, and that's how he operates. And it goes into his ties with being a celebrity, how he first made his first $14 million, and just the general tenor of who this person is, Travis, whatever his last name, Malenik, just doesn't seem like someone I'd want to support in any way. At the same,
Kalanick.
At the same time, I am assuming... So... When I first heard of Uber and started using it, it was actually after I used Lyft the first time, I was really impressed with the interface. I was really impressed with how they were doing things. I thought, this makes a lot of sense. You know, I didn't care about the cab companies. You know, I was very pro this. But part of that was this way that I think of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. I think of, you know, the leaders of Google or of Facebook or even of Netflix. And I see those people that started the businesses and I go, I respect them. I understand them at some level, it feels like. And I kind of trust them. And I kind of been giving that to Silicon Valley entrepreneurs for a long time because I feel like I'm in that camp. And I think that's really a naive perspective to have. And
this, I would agree with you there.
And reading this is quite enlightening. Well, you would agree though that Sergey Brin is a really good person, right?
Sergey Brin?
Yeah.
I have not met him personally. I've, you know,
this is Google.
Walked by him. Yeah. But I mean, I don't know per se. Everything I've seen of him in public life, yes, I think that he comes across as someone with a good moral center.
Yeah. And I think in general, the businesses that I've talked about, I definitely feel that way about Reed Hastings. But of course, I've met him and I kind of know who he is at some level. But a lot of these people that have started up tech companies and when you start hearing about their philosophy seems kind of great. At the same time, we don't really know the motivations of people. But more than that, that person's lead position and what they were at one point cannot denote what the company will become in some period of time later. And this guy, the guy that runs Uber, it's clearly the entire company is kind of around that same philosophy of who he is, which I don't think is ethical. And so I want to avoid that company quite a bit. But more than that, when we think about who's going to be running Facebook in 20 years, it certainly will not be Zuckerberg.
Right.
It'll be some other people. It'll
probably 20 years, I don't know.
Well, yeah, he might do it 20 years, but at some point, right? 40 mm-hmm. years, whatever. There'll be a board. There'll be other people. There'll be a completely different tact on what should be done and what shouldn't be done. And it will be motivated not by someone who has a vision of making the world better necessarily. And that's the concern I've got with these companies at this point. And I think I've voiced this before on the show, mm-hmm. that it's just a matter of time before their power is in the hands of unethical people. And they're all over the place, of course. Or uncaring people, right? Like, I don't know if the person that wrote this code that did the hell application that tracked Lyft users and Uber users inside of Uber, I don't know if that engineer was thinking about the ethical ramifications of what they were doing. They had a software problem in front of them. They were just thinking, well, I'm doing the software problem. They might not have been as educated as you are in what is ethically valid. And I think we are faulting that in our education of software engineers.
Yeah. Although Uber has its own issues, like, for example, this software was called Hell. There's also a piece of software they have called Heaven or God View, which was a tool for tracking the location of customers. It was also being publicly found to be abused by Uber employees to stalk journalists, celebrities, and ex-girlfriends.
Right.
So
that's pretty horrible. What you're basically talking about is that once you have credit card information on somebody, you know who they are, and they have an app on their phone that's telling you, your servers, where they are all the time. So you can just track them whenever you want. If the customer is an active customer, you just know where they are all the time. And we've covered some stories about that in the past. And, of course, at the time we covered that, we thought that it was bad security practice at Uber and that those employees would be punished. But it's really systemic in the culture there.
Right. It just makes me wonder, what is the rationale you have as a software engineer, not with this one incident, but all of the things that have been coming out about Uber over and over and over again? At what point do you say the place I'm working at is not a good place to be?
Well,
at the
same time, executives are leaving. I mean, people are leaving the company.
Right. But at the same time, like, what is the case for people working at Comcast or AT&T or Verizon, who have also had their share of issues? I've known personally a Comcast employee, and he was not particularly bullish on it.
Right. I mean, to some degree, you do the job you have. I just got a recruiting letter from Facebook, and as a software engineer, you get those a lot, especially when, you know, you got LinkedIn and you're connected to people. It's pretty easy for recruiters to contact you. And this letter caught my eye. I don't really know why. I always ignore them. This one, I paid attention. So I looked and was like, what kind of careers they have? At some point, I want to go into management. Maybe I'll do a management by switching companies. It's not something I'm probably going to do, but I went and looked at their site and watched a video. Now, we've been pretty... I would say fair on Facebook, but from an outside perspective here on the show, you and I at least. And talking about it in general, I kind of mostly get this idea that there is a boundary of employees versus non-employees, and the people that work at Facebook kind of have a different feeling and understanding of what Facebook's mission is and what they do versus us. And I have said flippantly to people, I'd never work at Facebook. I think they're evil. I don't really feel that way, but it's interesting to see that perspective. It's easy to have that perspective when you're not on the inside. I watched this little video, which is just a recruiting video on their website. You can see it at facebook.com/careers. There's a few videos there. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, I'm like, yeah, they're affecting a lot of people. It's a lot of change there. I get motivated me to mm-hmm. think about being there. That was moments. That's, you know, I'm working really hard at work right now, so maybe that's why I looked at the email. But just a video of 20 seconds got me kind of excited about the idea of, yeah, change the world, big impact. Yeah, okay, that's kind of cool. I mean, at work, I help people watch TV. At work there, they connect people together and help them share their own visual, you know, own stories. So it was really interesting to see just that little bit of perspective shift from what the internal drive is of these companies. So you don't know what the internal drive is of the people that were at Uber and what they thought they were doing. You know, making transport better, getting rid of bad cars. At some point, we'll have self-driving cars and we'll, you know, stop people from accidents. Think of all the waste we're having, all the pollutants we're having by having all these vehicles, extra vehicles, all the traffic we're going to solve. There are good reasons to work for a company like Uber. I just don't see it.
My concern is if you have a company that apparently can play fast and loose with the rules, with what you would say would be basic ethics.
Yeah.
Why would I trust that company with building, debugging, and testing a self-driving vehicle. I mean, most of the time with software, the worst thing that happens is you get a glitch, your credit card doesn't process, or the server goes down, you can't get access.
You can't download the RSS file.
Right. But they're getting into, we want driverless cars, and we're the ones building them, and aside from getting sued by Waymo for stealing trade secrets from Alphabet. But the fact that they were...
Those names just sound made up, by the way.
Right. Sorry. But they got caught trying to do stuff in San Francisco that
was... The New York Times article talks about this, right?
Yeah, was blatantly...
I mean, to be clear, some of the things they did, if you haven't read this article, some of the things that Uber did very specifically was they made it... As San Francisco were like, hey, you're called Uber Taxi, and you're running a taxi service in our city, but we have taxi rules. You haven't applied for a license. You haven't done all the things you need to do. And so what did Uber do? They didn't go ahead and made an office and start applying for the rules. No, they attacked the Congress people. They attacked the mayor, and they basically... pushed their user base to email them, mass email them, and call them. In fact, they added a tab on their app in that area that showed you how much slower, how much bad the service would be, how much more expensive the service would be if this new rule was implemented, or if they had to follow this rule, and then invited all their users in that area to email the people in charge of legislation to change the law.
And those were the early days.
And it worked.
Yeah, they became a libertarian darling for it as well.
And that whole process worked. I mean, that's... It's kind of like what Change.org was doing with regard to being socially responsible, except that it was completely for their own business practice. It's pretty devious.
But in addition to that, when they were testing out their self-driving vehicle and they found that it was, you know, cutting off bicycle riders and doing some things that were not safe, and then the company backtracks and says, oh, no, that was the human that was inside. That wasn't the car. It was human error. When in fact it wasn't. And then they had to disclose all the problems they had to the DMV because the DMV, California DMV, was holding firm on them, saying, we're not going to give you the license to test these vehicles within the state unless you give us this data. And it turned out that they had a lot more issues. And the DMV, California DMV, to their credit, said, no, this is not safe. You're not following the rules. And cut them off. There's a trust issue there. And it would be nice if they remedied that, but they don't seem to be showing any signs of doing anything but doubling down every single time.
Here's another little tidbit of technical information. Will Straffren, the president of Pseudo Security Group, analyzed a version of Uber's app in late 2014. This is an article from TechCrunch. We'll be linked to from today's show. And he says that he revealed how a user did a fingerprinting. He called track, but used a fingerprinting on devices. Here's the quote from Will Straffren. Straffic. They were dynamically loading IOKit framework, a private framework, then dynamically loading some symbols from it to iterate through the device's registry, also very much forbidden. They have code to nab a few things from the registry, but the only persistent identifier that they actually use appears to be the device serial number. So that's what they were doing. And this is the tricky thing about Objective-C in general and how you use libraries in Objective-C. It's actually possible in that space to load things you're not supposed to load. And the way that we get protected from that is Apple reviews things. And mostly that review thing is a threat of potentially being figured out. And Uber did this well enough such that they weren't figured out. And it's obvious, as a software engineer, Miles, you understand that it's relatively easy to slip code in to a compiled application.
It depends. It depends upon the system. If the system is doing a fingerprint, if it's doing a checksum on it, then it can be difficult.
Well, they were loading this framework that's a private framework. They weren't supposed to load this framework.
Yeah.
But anyway... So more articles on that, but let's go ahead and cover another. You want to get out of the Uber's discussion?
I would very much like to get out of the Uber discussion.
Let me just fervently state, though, that please stop using Uber. There's no reason to use it at this point. I'm really negative on it. We've been covering this a while. When we first started talking about it, it was really about how they were treating their female engineers and how, you know, toxic environment it was. Listen back to multiple shows of ours. And since then, I just took it as read that we avoid using it. And so people are talking about, like, I'm going to catch an Uber. I'm like, you're using that as a, like, I'm going to Google something when you mean you're going to search something. And they're like, no, I'm using Uber. I'm like, no, you probably shouldn't. Like, they're pretty bad. And so I've been surprised that people are not catching on to this problem. And if you're an Uber driver, try using Lyft a little bit more. It might be good not to have Uber win this battle. Speaking of searching and Googling, a while ago we were on the show chatting and I said, oh yeah, you could use a different search engine. In fact, it's really easy with Chrome. And so I went ahead and switched to Bing. I've been using Bing on my Chrome browser. It's really, really easy. There's nothing different really, and it's a great search engine. It's easy to change. If you want to diversify the power you're giving to companies, I suggest it. Give Microsoft some love instead of Google. I don't know.
Bing or DuckDuckGo or,
yeah.
There's a long list in there, too.
Yeah. It's really easy to switch it. You can switch stuff when you're using, and we do like the Chrome browser, but we actually, do you use Netflix or Firefox?
Well, I develop with multiple browsers to make sure that whatever I'm doing looks correct in all of them, looking for the different features. But my primary browser at this point is Brave.
You've mentioned Brave a couple times. It's the...
It's a Chromium core, so the open source variant of Chrome or the base of
it. Okay, so why do you like it rather than Chrome?
A couple of reasons. One is that it is the equivalent of having Chrome or Firefox with Adblock added onto it. So it blocks ads, it prevents fingerprinting, so it checks, can block third-party cookies or looks for fingerprinting patterns and stops it. And the side result to that is that pages end up loading a lot faster because not all ad frameworks are actually written with performance in mind. And so the pages load faster, but what kind of sold it for me with Brave was the fact that you can load up the browser with money, in this case Bitcoin. And so the sites that you go to can actually get a portion of whatever money you put in to the system. And so, for example, if you went to geekspeak.org with Brave, you'd register an account for us to say, like, yes, we are the owners of geekspeak.org, and there would be a certain percentage of Bitcoin put in there to offset that loss of ad revenue is the idea.
Yeah.
So if, it doesn't really work as a monetary model until you start putting money in much the same way that, Netflix wouldn't work unless people were actually paying for subscriptions, to pay for those.
But Brave makes it easy to do that kind of thing.
It does. It's the first one I've seen that actually integrates it with the browser, and Adblock has been around for a long time, but it never had any way to supplement the payment system. There was an effort to try to make sure that the sites weren't just left out in the cold. Although some sites still do come up, for example, LA Times, that say, you're running an ad block, and so you don't get to see our content. And that's kind of fair.
I think that's relatively fair. I think it's appropriate thing to do.
It'd be nice. I mean, that's the thing.
It'd be great if they also offered a way to not pay, to pay them directly, which I think they do.
You can do a subscription. It'd be nice if they were able to see, you're using the Brave browser, and as long as you give a certain amount per. At the same time, I have these mixed feelings because a fair amount of revenue is not from the ads, but rather from the data they're collecting on us. Statement of if you're not paying for it, you are the product.
Right. All right, let's move on. You actually have a story about a virus, BrickerBot.
In a way.
Yeah, tell us about it.
BrickerBot is kind of a flip view of the Mirai botnet. Mirai is a botnet that, as opposed to taking control of an old XP machine, for example, it takes control of Internet of Things devices, so your security cameras,
things
like that, which tend not to have very good
security.
Mm-hmm. But they are internet capable, and many times you don't even have time to reconfigure them before they would be taken over, unless you isolated your network before you did so. And most people don't have the technical wherewithal to do that. Only people like our security geek Alex, that type of thing, and. So you have this massive botnet that's been doing a lot of damage. And BrickerBot, on the other hand, is something that it goes to these different devices, looks for security flaws, and it tries to patch them. But if they're the type of device that the author has found that they can't patch, it will erase the firmware effectively bricking the device.
It'll kill the device.
Yeah. And so far, about 2 million devices have been bricked so far.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Does the software actually also try to harden the security on the device if it has the capability?
Some reports that I'd seen were that way, and that there have been some other software out there that's been trying to patch the holes in them. And Mirai actually will infect the machine and then patch the holes so nothing else can get back in after them.
Interesting.
In some cases. But this is one case where it's kind of a proactive, this is a problem, we have these botnets. So
what do you think of the person that wrote the software?
This is complicated.
I mean, from the one side, these things unchecked cause damage.
Right. You're going into someone else's system without their permission. Right off the bat, it is not... You are not, you know, the hero of the story.
It's like finding people that speed and then popping their tires, right?
Yeah. There's a good analogy there.
So you're not pro BrickerBot. You didn't write it.
I'm not pro BrickerBot. No, they actually found the author to it. I'm not pro BrickerBot. But I have a hard time saying that it's a bad idea because I think of the network effect of it, which would be that manufacturers that didn't lock their systems down suddenly stop working.
That would be incentive for them to fix their product.
Right. But it's by nefarious means. At the same time, we just talked about Uber, and nefarious means seem to be part of business these days.
Unfortunately. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like. Just give them credit. Give us credit. Miles Elam, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Lyle Troxell, and today's show is episode 14 of season 17, China Tutors Uber for Pennies. Thank you, Greg Merkley, for that title. You're welcome to read more about our show and learn how to subscribe to it via podcast at geekspeak.org. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. I really feel like I have a lot of bots following me on Facebook.
On Facebook? On Twitter, I've got a huge number.
Yeah, I got bots on Twitter, too. Twitter is much more public persona for me.
On Facebook, you got bots?
Well, that's the thing is, I think so. I get requests to be friends by random users. And I pay attention now. I used to be like, oh, well, this person knows four people I know, so it must be someone from high school.
Oh.
I have a very bad memory for names, so I've said yes to them. The thing is, I've also mostly published stuff on Facebook publicly. And the reason for that is, of course, I have a public persona. You and I have been doing the show for 17 years, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a bit of a public persona. So I kind of like, I also assume that at some point, I mean, early on when Facebook was early, I thought, well, they'll get hacked just like everybody else. All the data I'm putting up is probably going to be, you know, public. So I shouldn't, you know, think of it as private. And therefore, I just thought of it as public. So all my posts are always public. So people can follow me and read everything I post anyway. And with the knowledge about how much other users can use the data you have, especially if there's bots that are following you, and they can track you and keep abreast of you and learn understand better the zeitgeist of your social circle and possibly alter public opinion in society because of it. I felt like, well, I should probably lead by example at some level and say enough of this. And so my first step was just to, well, I should just stop posting publicly. Almost everybody I know is already connected with me, so I can just post only to friends. That seems like one step. And then also delete all users that are not friends of mine or that I don't know directly. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a cleaning, if you will. And I know that in doing that, I will be deleting people that I might know, really. I'm just wondering, what's your practice on Facebook? What do you do?
In general, I assume that anything that's on Facebook is public.
So same as me, sure.
And to a large extent, I don't put anything up without thinking about what's the ramifications if anyone saw this. Mm-hmm. And in general, when I'm posting stuff, especially if it's a link to articles and things like that, because I tend to be political, I just post them as public because it takes away the pretense. This is public.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing pretty much the entire time. Yeah.
I do lock it down a little bit more when I post photos of things like my family. Mm-hmm. But I never post anything up there that I go like, oh, man, I don't want anyone to see this. Because if you don't want anyone to see it, you don't put it on a social network.
You don't put it on the internet.
Right. And so I do, you know, set to friends, friends only, when it's family. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'm always conscious that Facebook is not necessarily friendly.
You get in a lot of debates, a lot of political debates on Facebook.
And so I always just I think about what I'm going to be posting up there and just assume that it's public.
Yeah.
I don't think about it in terms of, well, I don't want someone to see this. So I'm going to manage my permission just so to be. I think that's fraud.
So I think that I've been fine with that idea for a long time. And now with the understanding of how much data is actually gleaned from a social network like that, from outside, like I used to think, well, Facebook can get all this data on me. Who really cares? But the truth is that now that data is anybody that sets up servers to start mm-hmm. mining it. And so, you know, with this system, it's relatively easy to understand my political viewpoint, who my friends are, and in general, kind of get a better understanding of how I think. And not by a person, but by a system that is getting more and more intelligent and not a human system. And I'm just curious at you know, what we're deciding to give away and how smart that is and what trade we're providing. Like, what's my motivation for doing that? I think my motivation is completely egotistical. I don't see any other reasons to share things except for to get yays and boos and, you know.
Sure.
And the truth is, there's a much smaller group of people that I actually care they're about their opinion. And I don't need to use Facebook to do that at all. I could actually see them more often. So I'm just, I guess I'm doing a bit of a shift on this.
My friends list, I have a lot of friends from high school that I keep in touch with on Facebook. And they are geographically dispersed around the world. So going to see them or calling them up on the phone just really isn't so much of an option.
But is it an important part of your life to know them?
It has been, actually. And this is where going to my 20-year reunion was interesting because we all saw each other online. And so we knew what was going on. So you skipped the, what have you been up to? And actually just, you got past that introductory step and actually had more fun conversations, I guess the best way to describe it. More like, I've been meaning to ask you this, and, you know, or, hey, let's reminisce about stuff, which was the point of a reunion.
Right.
I am unlike you in that I don't friend people and really never have that I don't know personally. With maybe two exceptions, and they were good friends of someone else that I knew well, that online we had shared stories and sure. They seemed like, you know, they were fun.
I used to have a very strict rule that I'd only, you know, friend people that I had met in MeetSpace. Mm-hmm. It seemed like it was a pretty good boundary to do. And then, you know, it became, there was people starting to follow me that listened to the show. And I was like, oh, okay, I can befriend them. I mean,
the thing though, is I'm pretty sure, I mean, because I saw Facebook has the feature follow,
yeah,
where you don't have to friend, they can follow. I'm like, that's sufficient.
I wish that I could translate friends into followers. you can't do that. You can't seem to do that. When you stop friending them, they just kind of disappear from your feed. I don't know. The other way to think about it is just only put in public stuff, just pull all of this stuff out. I don't know. That's
something I've actually admired about Twitter, which is, for the most part, it's just everything is public. Just that's how it is. Mm. And Twitter's had its problems, like with abuse and stuff like that. But that aspect of it, the simplicity of the security model, so you know what you're getting into, is appealing to me.
I mean, there's direct messaging, of course, which is private.
One-to-one, on a one-to-one basis, yes.
You can't do one-to-many? You might be able to do one-to-many now in messaging. We'll try. All right. Anything else you want to talk about in post-show? I mean, you've been coding a lot, but we could let that go and travel on for our day. Do you want to talk about code?
No, not really. I'm hoping maybe I'll catch the end of the Warriors game.
Seriously?
Sports? Yeah.
Is that a sports thing?
Game 4 of the first match of the playoffs for the Warriors.
Who are you?
Dude, I have always been a basketball person. I'm sorry.
Oh, Warriors is basketball?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember that. Used to kick my ass playing basketball.
Wait, you actually played basketball?
You and I used to shoot hoops.
Oh, you were actually playing basketball? I thought you were just kind of making spasmodic movements and flailing your arms wildly. This is why I let you get away with being mean to me at the beginning.
Good night.
Good night.